content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Land of Opportunity, Why Johnston County is the Fastest Growing County in North Carolina. And the cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline, Full Growth Mode, Johnston County is the state's fastest growing county, what's next? Written by Evan Hoopfer. Looking out over his family farm, Dean Penny points out memories from his childhood. This is where he learned how to farm tobacco. Over there is where he ran into an electric fence as a kid and burned his legs. And next to that barn is where he plucked scuppernogs off the vine and ate them until he got sick. The farm of his childhood will soon be gone. In November, the Clayton Town Council approved plans for the Copper District, a massive 69-acre mixed-use project that will include retail shops, apartments, single-family homes, and a hotel on the Penny Farm. Another major component is hundreds of thousands of square feet of Class A office space, a first for Johnston County. Construction is scheduled to start in the coming months. Penny is a member of the family that has owned the land for decades and will have a key role in developing it, and he is also part of Cary-based Craig Davis Properties, which is developing the Copper District. For me, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, Penny says. When do you ever get to have this opportunity with land that has been in your family? That opportunity doesn't come along. Even though Penny's sentimental ties to the land run deep, he knows Johnston County is rapidly changing, as it was the fastest-growing county in North Carolina during the 2010s. The reality is this is not going to stay a farm. Whether it's in my lifetime or my kids' lifetime, it's not going to stay a farm. The land is too valuable for that, Penny says. Our desire is to see it developed in a very tasteful, high-quality way. The project represents the next step in Johnston County's evolution. The community that was focused on agriculture for decades began to boom about 30 years ago as improved roads better connected Wake and Johnston counties. The most apparent sign of growth, to the consternation of some local residents, were the rooftops popping up in areas where rows of tobacco once stood. As prices soared in Wake, home builders and home buyers sought cheaper options in Johnston. For the community's next step, local leaders don't want Clayton, Smithfield, and Selma to simply be bedroom communities for Raleigh, Durham, and Research Triangle Park. They want the area to be self-sustaining and view projects such as the Copper District as a key cog in the county's economic engine of the future and a means to keep Johnston County residents in Johnston County. When I'm speaking to prospective clients considering our area, they say, well, where do I get my workforce when you're at 3.5% unemployment? Says Chris Johnson, director of the Johnston County Office of Economic Development. I'm like, well, we've got 105,000 in our workforce, but half leave the county every day. That's where you're going to get them from. Interstate interest. For several decades in mid-20th century, growth was stagnant in Johnston County. Between 1940 and 1970, the county's population actually decreased from about 63,800 to 61,700 people, according to U.S. Census figures. The county really started to change in 1990, Johnson says, when I-40 opened. That's also the same year Johnson, an eastern North Carolina native whose wife's family is from Johnston County, moved to the county. A lot of developers and investors that were looking at the region saw Johnston County as low-hanging fruit, he said. If I-40 started the Johnston County boom, then the construction of several other interstates in and around the county will accelerate growth. The stretch of U.S. Highway 70 from I-40 to Morehead City has been designated as future I-42. That stretch runs right through Johnston County, giving it another high-speed corridor to the coast. Another major project is the completion of Southern I-540 loop, which started in 2019. Johnson calls it one of the most important infrastructure developments for his county. Everything that I sell is the close proximity to Raleigh, the three major universities, and the airport, Johnson says. When 540 gets opened up, we're just going to be 15 minutes closer. And just last year, the U.S. Highway 421 corridor from Greensboro to Dunn was given high priority status in the federal infrastructure bill, which bodes well for the road becoming I-685 one day and linking up Johnston County with megasites in Chatham County and the Triad. All these future interstate projects will help Johnston County recruit companies. Even though Johnston County doesn't have a mega site of its own, its proximity to Triangle Innovation Point in Moncure, the Chatham-Siler City Advanced Manufacturing Site, and the Greensboro-Randolph mega site means ample opportunities exist for suppliers which will serve those original equipment manufacturing plants. Johnson recalls when the Mazda Toyota manufacturing plant was deciding between North Carolina and Alabama. During that process, he was often on the phone with Japanese suppliers scouting sites in Johnston County until the car makers announced they were bringing their $2.3 billion plant to Huntsville. The two main interstates that run through Johnston County act as vital arteries connecting the county with the East Coast. A newly formed economic development organization is looking to leverage the marketing power of those two interstates. The I-95, I-40, Crossroads of America Economic Development Alliance officially started in August and is focused on bringing jobs to Four Oaks, Benson, and Dunn, the latter of which sits in Harnett County. The mayors of those three towns got together and basically said, we've got to do something about economic development and workforce in this region. Our name is always in the hat for projects statewide, but we fall short for workforce development reasons and some infrastructure things. We've got to do something to address this, says Reed Williams, president of the new organization. I-40 and I-95 are not something that have been collectively marketed in this region ever since they came through the area. The mayor said, what a great opportunity we have. The alliance's jurisdiction is along I-95 from exit 90 in Four Oaks to exit 70 in Dunn. The basic premise of why the organization started is those three towns thought their economic development prospects were stronger working together than competing against one another. A win for one of us is a win for all of us, Williams says. Grow, grow, grow. Johnston County is where the economies of the Triangle and eastern North Carolina bleed into one another. In Johnston County, you'll find a $340 million facility, Grifols, opened in 2015 to help the healthcare company treat rare and chronic diseases, and the over 1,000-acre Fred Smith Company Ranch, which raises cattle. Agriculture and a rural conservative way of life are still central to Johnston County's identity, which differentiates it from the rest of the Triangle. For example, in the 2020 presidential election, Joe Biden received 62% of the vote in Wake County, 80% in Durham, and 75% in Orange. In Johnston County, Donald Trump received 61% of the vote. Johnston has maintained this identity even as people flock to the county. Johnston County was the fastest growing in the North Carolina during the 2010s and is now home to about 215,000 people, according to the U.S. Census, making it the 12th largest county in the state. With the influx of people came an onslaught of new home construction. Between 2010 and 2020, the number of homes in Johnston County increased 24.6%, from about 67,700 to 84,300, according to the U.S. Census data. That growth rate was also number one in the state. Much more housing is in the pipeline, too. Last year, Raleigh's Greenfield Communities purchased 230 acres with plans to build 850 new homes near Wilson's Mills. And hometown developer River Wild is working on several Clayton communities, including Ashcroft Section 2, 772 homes, Academy Point, 255 homes, and Riverwood Golf Section 2, 726 homes. Our market here in Johnston County is really just driven by a price point advantage, by Wake County just being overpriced, says Reed Smith, founder and CEO of Clayton-based River Wild. Our ability to offer affordable shelter that really doesn't exist in Wake County anymore to people commuting to Wake County, but also people wanting to live a little further out and work here, has also allowed this market to really take off. That growth has rankled some longtime residents like Terry Ballot. She's lived in Johnston County for 14 years and today runs a retail store called The Twisted Willow in downtown Smithfield that sells antiques and farmhouse and bohemian items. Ballot and her husband John got their start in the industry by salvaging old church pews up and down the East Coast and selling them. Some of the buyers include major television shows, including The Walking Dead. Billet has lived in places like Greensboro, Burlington, and Raleigh. She also lived in Morrisville during the days when subdivisions were scarce in that town and relocated south to the Cleveland School area in Johnston County, seeking a different lifestyle as Morrisville swelled. I moved down to Johnston County to get away from the hustle and bustle, she says. But if anybody knows the Cleveland School area, the sad part is you see these farmhouses and farmlands and stuff that people have owned forever. They're ripping it up to put new roads in. Since Ballot moved, tens of thousands of people also moved to Johnston County, seeking the same characteristics she found appealing. She was asked if Johnston County is going to be a place she wants to live in 10 years. That's a hard one, says Blatt, acknowledging that increased foot traffic in places like downtown Smithfield is good for her business. But then on the other side of it, how much is this going to grow over the next 10 years? Is it going to end up like a Morrisville again? And if so, is that really a place I want to live in? She says. Copper District. The Copper District is not the first time a piece of penny property has been developed across the street since Johnson Health Clayton, a hospital, part of the UNC health system, that opened in 2009 and was built on penny land. For the 69 acres, which sit along NC Highway 42, the Penny family wanted a big impact. The family did not want a big box store on the land, for example, Dean Penny says. One of the chief goals for the project is bringing more health care to Johnston County, and the medical industry is a target industry for the office space. The first office building and multifamily complex are scheduled to come online in 2024, he says. The office buildings are going to be 6 to 10 stories, Penny says. You can drive around Clayton and you're not going to see anything near that kind of density. The investment Craig Davis Properties is making is significant. Penny pegged it at over $500 million. The town of Clayton is investing a sizable chunk of money in this project, too. The town and Craig Davis Properties agreed to an incentive package last year that includes a grant of 50% of the ad valorem taxes paid to the development team for 7 years beginning in 2024. The total amount of incentives paid out would be capped at $2.5 million. Another goal of the project is to preserve the land's history in different ways, like refurbishing the old International Harvester 424 tractor that's currently on the land and displaying it in some way. Penny would also like to have trellises with grapevines growing on them, an ode to his childhood when he snacked on scuppernogs. The goal is to create a catalyst for Johnston County's evolution. I grew up with a generation where most of us were living in Johnston County and working in Wake County, Penny says. I want to change that. I think there's a growing number of people that would rather live here and work here, and we're going to create that opportunity. And now we turn to the continuing series, 52 Shades of Success. The headline, Making Millionaires. Entrepreneur Ashok Mathur's goals are to build his health tech firm and handsomely reward early adopters of his vision. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ plus community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project also will delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. Tech entrepreneurs typically set out to create solutions that fill a void in the market. Rarely do they set out to make their employees rich. Ashok Mathur, founder and CEO of Patagonia Health, is eyeing both. The company developed apps and cloud-based software for electronic health records, EHR, that have made record-keeping easier and more efficient for behavioral health providers and public health departments. And the company has also built wealth for employees who are vested in Mathur's vision. His goal, Mathur says, has been to create millionaires. If the privately held company he started in 2009 was sold today, he expects there are 7 people who would become millionaires. Between current and former employees, about 50 people own shares in the company. The idea of creating wealth for employees first intrigued him in 2006 when he learned a number of employees at Cary-based A4 Health Systems, led by John McConnell, became millionaires when the company was sold for $272 million to Chicago-based Allscripts in a cash stock deal. When Patagonia Health launched in the throes of the Great Recession, the concept of making millionaires became the path forward and the foundation on which Mathur grew the company. The business climate then was the opposite of today. People were scrambling to find jobs, but venture capital was non-existent. Luckily for us, a lot of talent was available, he says. Big companies like IBM had layoffs and students were not getting internships, so we had unemployed people and students from NC State University and Duke who came and helped build software with us. Here's the deal, I told them. Come help us, but keep looking for a job. You'll get new technology experience while you work for us, and we'll give you stock options. The catch was that all employee compensation was given in stock options. There was no money to pay salaries. They didn't believe the stock options were worth anything, but as it turns out, they are worth a lot now, Mathur quips. We did it like that for a long time. I spent my own money. It was all bootstrapped financing, no outside funding. Now, so much money is available, we get calls to see if we want investors. An entrepreneurial engineer at heart, Mazur has thrived on building technology solutions and forward-thinking teams from when he worked for Nortel Networks in Canada, followed by his first stint in North Carolina, and then a return to his native India, where he built a Nortel team of more than 800 software engineers in less than 5 years. When it came time to put down roots for his own company, the Triangle beat Silicon Valley and Texas, partly because of the quality of life in this area, but also because of the support for entrepreneurial startups. In 2010, Patagonia Health received a $40,000 grant from NCIDEA. Apart from the financial boost, it was also validation to Mature that they were on the right track. It was a slow grind, but once we hit $1 million in revenue, which took about 3 years, then we knew we had something, he says. Getting public health customers in 2012 was a really big deal. The county health directors believed in what we were doing and were very helpful and collaborative. Then we realized nobody was serving this need across the nation, so there was no limit to where we could go. The vast majority of Patagonia Health's business, 90%, stems from public health departments, and 10% is made up of behavioral health agencies, but that segment is growing rapidly. The cloud-based software was ideal for rural areas because they could easily access support. North Carolina state government had provided health departments with free EHR software, but it was very cumbersome and not easy to use, Mature explains. In addition to serving roughly half of the counties in North Carolina, public health in the state is managed at the county level. Patagonia Health has customers in 28 states and Puerto Rico. In 2021, company revenue reached $10 million, and there are 75 employees, 45 in the Triangle and 30 located in India. Mature's penchant for turning problems into possibilities surfaced again during the pandemic. Initially, new business ground to a halt and the training side of Patagonia Health's business model also disappeared. The company was forced to lay off 10 to 15 employees. As 2020 progressed, Mature says, the move to telehealth and had a fantastic impact on our business. We innovated and came up with a COVID screening app, and then when the vaccine came out in December 2020, we developed a mass vaccination app, which enabled a health department to vaccinate people very quickly through contactless registration. It was a massive success, and in terms of revenue, we bounced back to normal by the end of 2021. The Hope County Health Department has relied on Patagonia Health for its EHR software since 2013. One of the fastest growing counties in the state, the population grew over 47% from 1990 to 2000 and another 17% in the 2 decades leading to 2019. The Hoke Health Department has experienced a surge in demand. In 2018, they saw 6,500 cases. In 2021, the patient load had increased to 10,000 cases. As health director for Hoke County, Helene Edwards says the EHR system has saved the health department time and resources, as well as provided accessible analysis on services rendered and trending needs. One of our challenges is that there are not a lot of medical providers in Hope County. We have one physician for every 1,300 people, she says. Challenges are compounded by the population, about half of which is affiliated with the military or has some form of insurance, and the other half is uninsured. We have racial disparities across the county with many residents from historically marginalized populations, the Lumbee tribe, Hispanics, blacks, as well as some Iranian and Afghan refugees, and we want to provide equitable resources for all. Patagonia has a dashboard that gives us data at our fingertips, Edwards says. Even a feature as simple as the communications app saved the staff considerable time by replacing phone calls with text reminders, and it created more access to healthcare during COVID when appointments were limited. The app enabled cancellations to be seamlessly filled with patients on the wait list. Both Mature and Edwards are advocates of the Public Health 3.0 initiative, launched in 2016 by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, with the goal of leveraging data and resources to address social, environmental, and economic conditions that affect health and health equity. When people come in for a health issue, there are other issues that could be compounding the problem. If you live in a poorer community or a certain ethnicity, if there is a higher rate of violence or unemployment in the community, these are social determinants of health, Mature says. 10 years from now, we want to have changed the way we treat a person in the community and be at Public Health 3.0. And there are also two news items in the 52 Shades of Success section. Foundation awards NCCU $1.8 million STEM grant. The North Carolina GlaxoSmithKline Foundation awarded a $1.8 million grant to NC Central University to encourage students from underrepresented minorities to pursue careers in pharmaceutical and life sciences. The grant funds a four-year initiative that will expand educational opportunities and further science and research exposure with the goal of creating a new pipeline of students who will seek STEM degrees in pharmaceutical sciences, clinical research, and other science, technology, engineering, or math. The program will include a biotech summer immersion experience beginning this year for more than 180 rising 10th and 11th grade high school students who will each receive a $1,000 stipend to attend. The grant will also fund the NC GlaxoSmithKline Foundation Scholars, 61st year NCCU freshmen, providing scholarships to include tuition, fees, near-peer mentoring, skills training, and professional development opportunities. Additionally, the program will provide professional and skills development workshops for public, middle, and high school teachers and community college students. March Madness rolls on. The Triangle Thunder, a Division II team in the National Wheelchair Basketball Association, is ranked 12th in the nation and has earned a spot in the 2022 NWBA Toyota Wheelchair Basketball National Championships, scheduled for March 31 through April 2nd in Wichita, Kansas. The team is a recreational and competitive program for men and women with a variety of disabilities to participate in the sport of wheelchair basketball. The Triangle's hometown team is trying to raise money to fund travel expenses to the national tournament. Businesses interested in supporting the team should contact Mike Atkins, team founder, at matkins, A-T-K-I-N-S, at stallsmedical, S-T-A-L-L-S, medical.com. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. New project on the rise. A project years in the making is starting to take shape at a site of the Country Club Homes cottages that were part of the Raleigh landscape since right after World War II. A massive sea of dirt shows the breadth of a project that will transform an area right beside Oberlin, formerly Daniels Middle School. Last April, Grub Ventures, Williams Realty and Building Company, and Clancy and Thays Construction Company announced plans for the site that cost $24 million in 2006. Plans for Budley East call for 23 single-family homes, roughly 73 townhomes and condominiums, 13 cottages, a four-story apartment building with 170 units, and a substantial senior living community called Hayes Barton Place. Residential construction is scheduled to begin in June. Hayes Barton Place is expected to open in 2024 and will have 214 independent living options. The current plan is 169 condo-style residences, ranging from 800 square feet to over 3,000 square feet. There will be 24 flats ranging in size from 1,800 to 2,000 square feet, and 21 townhomes that offer 2,500 to 2,800 square feet. And there will be 88 private accommodations for assisted living, memory support, and more. Liberty Senior Living says it has been honored and humbled by the interest in the project and anticipates taking deposits for particular floor plans and locations soon. Pinehurst honors Donald Ross with coin. A new coin commemorating golf course legend Donald Ross is raising money for the Tufts Archives in Pinehurst, which details the history of the village. The $25 coin, commissioned by the Pinehurst, Southern Pines, Aberdeen Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, shows Ross and the cottage in Pinehurst where he lived for many years. Ross came to the U.S. from Scotland and gave his courses a feel of the links from back in his homeland, including the masterful Pinehurst No. 2. The coin commemorates his 150th birthday. Ross was born November 23, 1872, in Dornoch, Scotland. LPGA champ pitches wine business. Christy Carr, the 2007 U.S. Women's Open champion at Pine Needles Lodge and Golf Club, was on hand March 9 at the Raleigh Country Club to offer a taste of the products out of her vineyard in Napa Valley, California. About 90 members of the club and invited guests heard Carr's journey from a golf pro to a winery owner as executive chefs from several McConnell Golf properties showcased their culinary skills over a five-course dinner. As for playing golf, Carr said she is still committed to the tour, but her wine business is taking more of her time as Carr Cellars grows to one of the premier boutique wineries in the country. I would love to come play at the U.S. Women's Open in Pine Needles this year, Carr says, noting, I need an exemption from the United States Golf Association to play, and I need everyone to reach out to the USGA to forward my case. Spotted at the event were several area executives, including Larry Robbins from Wyrick Robbins, McConnell Golf CEO John McConnell, and entrepreneur Glenn Futrell, who co-founded and sold his Raleigh Engineering Company, S&ME, a few years back. Downtown site seeks big price tag. The owners of a slice of historic downtown Raleigh are putting their building up for sale, advertising a fully leased property on Fayetteville Street with development potential up to 40 stories high. The property is situated on 0.21 acres at 414 Fayetteville Street, dates to 1958, and features 24,015 square feet of fully leased retail and office space. County records list the owner as Millstream Properties, LLC, managed by Bobby Lewis. Marketing materials by broker CityPlat show the seller is seeking $8.7 million for the property and lays out potential development possibilities. Grant to aid former QVC employees. North Carolina received a $4 million federal grant recently that will be used to help people who worked at the QVC distribution center in Rocky Mount before a fire destroyed much of the building last year. For example, eligible workers can receive free training services where local employers partner with community colleges. The grant is intended to help 650 former QVC employees. The fire started in the early morning of December 18. Nearly 2,000 employees were laid off after the blaze, as QVC said there won't be available work for the foreseeable future while it assesses its options. And finally, new businesses for Park West Village. Park West Village is expanding again, this time with tenants. The bustling Morrisville Retail Center has six new businesses opening this summer: Piata Italian Street Food, Leo's Italian Social, Fang Sha, and Red Hot and Blue will be rounding out the food and beverage offerings at the center. And Stretch Lab and Restore Hyper Wellness will be joining as well. Developer Casto of Columbus, Ohio, filed plans with the town for a new phase of Park West Village, including 115 new apartments, a fifth Third Bank branch, and space for a future commercial building. And now we turn to the On Tech and Travel page, written by Lauren Onasorge. Finding a connection. Triangle firms look to support colleagues who are in Ukraine. Ann Schlemmer, CEO of Percona in Durham, thought navigating the open-source software company through a global pandemic was stressful, and then Russia invaded Ukraine. Planning for business continuity when nearly two dozen of your employees are on the ground in Ukraine amid the very real threat of shelling and cluster bombs forced her to take her leadership to another level. Schlemmer isn't alone. Multiple Triangle companies have boots on the ground in Ukraine, and the commonality from their Triangle teams is a desire to support their colleagues. "This is our culture, that we take care of each other," says Mick Charles, the Raleigh-based senior vice president of people operations at Single Store, a database management company with a team based in Kyiv. "This is the right thing to do for our colleagues. I know each and every one of them would do the same for us." At Percona, employees have actually worked to find housing for colleagues trying to escape the war zone, Schlemmer says. At Single Store, the company is also trying to help, putting forward relocation packages intended to help employees get out of combat areas. While employees are spending a lot of time offline dealing with the very real trauma of what President Joe Biden has called Russian President Vladimir Putin's vicious war of choice, some employees of both companies continue to get work done, finding it a good distraction from what is happening outside, both Schlemmer and Charles say. "They want to work as a distraction, but also they want things to be as normal as possible," Charles says. That's as, back at home, colleagues stateside are taking on extra projects as another way to help. "We truly believe the best way to support our colleagues is to help the business keep going," Schlemmer says. Wake County bankruptcies are still low. While bankruptcy numbers are still down, particularly in Chapter 11 reorganizations, attorneys say they are starting to see more inquiries from business owners facing financial hurdles. RDU's cash cow routes get shuffled. Pre-pandemic, Boston's Logan International reigned supreme, with data showing in 2019 that the route was Raleigh-Durham International Airport's biggest revenue-generating flight. Then COVID-19 struck, business travel tanked, and the game completely changed. New numbers for 2021 released by aviation analytics firm OAG show a new mix of revenue generators, with Los Angeles, not Boston, topping the list for RDU at $21.8 million. And in a section called He Said It, a quote from Dogwood State Bank CEO Steve Jones, after announcing its new headquarters would be at a planned Dominion Realty Tower in downtown Raleigh. "We're excited about the brand exposure for sure. It's just such a perfect gateway in the city of Raleigh." And finally, we have a tweet of the week. The tweet is from @JimKitchen. "It's official. I'm going to space with @BlueOrigin. Professor Jim Kitchen of the UNC Kenan Flagler Business School has been picked to go to space, alongside people like Pete Davidson of Saturday Night Live. Kitchen will be a passenger on a Blue Origin flight scheduled for March 23rd. And now we turn to the On Greater Triangle Growth page, written by Evan Hoopfer. Eastfield Crossing sees major interest. First industrial building and park near Selma opens in April. Eastfield Crossing, located outside Selma along Interstate 95, has seen a flurry of activity lately. "We're really excited about our prospects for the future," says Kevin Doherty, president and owner of Adventure Development, the developer behind Eastfield. "I think there's certainly room for some really unique draws," he says. Construction on the shell of Building 100, the first industrial building within the park, is slated to finish by the end of April, Doherty says. He says interest has been high for the 135,000-square-foot building, especially given the ultra-low vacancy rate for industrial space in the Triangle. The goal is to have a tenant in place before summer. Arco Design Build is providing design and construction services, and Phoenix Commercial is handling leasing for the building. More industrial development is slated for Eastfield as it recently landed a $750,000 grant from the North Carolina Railroad Company that will be used to help clear about 100 acres of the park that could attract a large industrial user. On the retail end of things, Carolina Wholesale Flooring recently announced it was opening a location within the Triangle East Collaborative, TEC, in Eastfield. The company is a wholesaler for luxury vinyl and laminate flooring. Also within TEC will be Old North State Food Hall, which is set to open in early summer. Doherty says the goal is to have the food hall open for the busy summer travel season as Johnston County sits halfway between New York and Miami. Other major retailers are eyeing Eastfield too, Doherty says. He declined to name names, but says, "I hope to be able to make an announcement in the next month or so with 7 anchors and junior anchors in our phase one that will ideally be opened in the summer of 23. Porsche warehouse in Rocky Mount sold for $3 million. A large warehouse for Porsche parts in Rocky Mount traded hands recently. The DC Automotive facility bills itself as the largest warehouse for Porsche parts in the U.S. The facility sits at 320 Commerce Court in Rocky Mount and is about 140,000 square feet in size. The facility sold to Pre-Venture, a business based in Lutz, Florida, for $3 million, according to a deed filed March 4. Pre-Venture invests in many different types of real estate, such as condominium units, apartment buildings, commercial properties, and hotels and motels. "I bought it because it had a great cash flow, and I plan on holding on to the property for a long time," says Burju Patel, owner of Pre-Venture. Rob Zampardi started DC Automotive, and it's known throughout the country for its extensive Porsche parts inventory, which consists of used and new parts like engines, transmissions, Fuchs wheels, and seats for a variety of Porsche models. Roxborough apartments sell for big profit. An apartment complex in Roxborough sold for $8 million recently. Brookwood Apartments at 390 Henderson Road on the northeast side of town is home to 90 units. The buyer is an LLC addressed to the Millennia Companies of Cleveland. This marks the second sale in the last few years for Brookwood Apartments. The seller, an LLC addressed to New York City's Homewood Real Estate Partners, bought the complex for $5.35 million in April 2017, according to Person County deed records. That means the price tag for Brookwood Apartments has risen almost 50% in just under 5 years. And now in a section called She Said It, a quote from Natalie Hawkins, executive director of Moore County Partners in Progress, on implementing a program similar to Lee County's. The program would aim to boost industrial development in Moore County and bring more jobs to the county. "I think that a speculative industrial building program in Moore County is feasible." And finally, a big number, 1,179, the number of new homes Sanford approved during its city council meeting March 1. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Brumette. Cary Brewery goes into expansion mode. Brent Webb plans new concept at Oyster Bar at McGregor Village. Brent Webb, founder of Cotton House Craft Brewers and Triangle Beer Company, has taken over Tony's Taps and Oyster Bar, a fixture in Cary's McGregor Village Shopping Center, for around 30 years. He plans to turn the space into a new restaurant called Salt, with the goal of keeping the space's live music reputation while elevating the menu. Salt will open as a steak and seafood concept at the end of April. The move is Webb's second acquisition aimed at fueling growth. When realizing the need for more production space for Cotton House Craft Brewers, Webb acquired the Jordan Lake Brewing Company and turned its downtown Cary space into Triangle Beer Company, which opened last year. When the food concept at Triangle Beer Company had outgrown its space, Webb purchased Tony's for its large kitchen area. Selling Triangle Beer Company beer directly to consumers is Webb's main strategy. Distribution costs for a small brewery, such as packaging and shipping, aren't worth the return, he says. We prefer to sell our beer out of the glass to customers, Webb says. I haven't addressed distribution at all, really, and that's been on purpose. We feel like the venue-based strategy with direct-to-consumer offerings is a stronger business model, and I think it's one of the things that helped us through COVID. Along with Triangle Beer Company brews, Salt will serve entrees ranging from $15 to $20 with some higher-end specials. The revitalized restaurant will have seating for around 125 and will continue turning the dining room into a dance floor with live music on the weekends, Webb says. Salt's largest kitchen will also have room for Webb's Craft Concepts kitchen and its catering services. Craft Concepts previously operated solely out of a trailer at the Triangle Beer Company location. On March 19, the physical Triangle Beer Company space will be officially rebranded to Triangle Beer Company and Kitchen, and new food offerings will be available through the existing trailer. The location will also be adding craft cocktails to its drink menu. Chef Kyle Fletcher, executive chef at Raleigh's brew pub Y Hill Kitchen and Brewing, has been hired to lead the new restaurant. He recently made it to the fourth and final round of the 2021 NCRLA Chef Showdown. Charlotte's Meridian Waste continues Triangle acquisitions. In 3 months, Meridian Waste has acquired four companies to establish a foothold in the Greater Triangle. The non-hazardous solid waste services company, headquartered in Charlotte, purchased Goldsboro-based Pinnacle Waste and Sanford-based Triad Waste as part of its aggressive growth strategy. The two companies will transition to the Meridian Waste name and move operations to Chatham County, giving Meridian access to both the Triad and the Triangle. The recent purchases follow Meridian's acquisitions of Raleigh's Dump Stars and Clayton's Discount Dumpsters on December 30th. The company places significant focus on tuck-in acquisitions with an emphasis on new geographic expansion opportunities, a spokesperson said. Meridian has completed 6 acquisitions in North Carolina and 22 total since 2018. Christensen to debut BB's in Durham. Ashley Christensen's fast casual chicken chain is opening its second location this month and marking the chef's first venture outside of Raleigh. BB's Crispy Chicken will be opening in University Hill, a mixed-use development in Durham, on March 25. The concept is a partnership between Christensen and investment and management firm MDO Holdings. BB's first location opened in Raleigh's Midtown East Shopping Center on October 30th. A third location is planned for Cary. The $1.1 million build-out at the Durham location includes seating for 54 indoors and 25 outdoors, says Doug Warf, president of MDO Holdings. And in a section called She Said It, a quote from Margaret Szczesny on opening Chef Chick's European Bakery in Durham's Meridian Business Park. I've been in accounting and finance since I was 16. While I enjoyed it, that isn't what I would say my passion is in. It's always been my dream to open a bakery. And finally, a big number, $98.68. The average daily rate for hotels in Wake County in January 2022. Pre-pandemic ADRs were $106.44 in January 2020 and $104.74 in January 2019, according to global hospitality data and analytics company STR. And turning to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger, Salisbury Square is getting ready to rise. Two-tower project will be headquarters for Dogwood State Bank. Construction is scheduled to begin in the coming months on a two-tower development in downtown Raleigh that will be the new headquarters for a local bank. The developers behind Salisbury Square, Dominion Realty Partners of Raleigh, and New York Real Estate Investors will kick off construction this May on the development's first phase after buying the land for the project in a $35.5 million deal that closed recently. Raleigh's Dogwood State Bank will take up space in Phase 1 for the bank's new headquarters. The site is situated on 4.9 acres at 700 South Salisbury Street and sits in an opportunity zone. The seller, North Carolina Association of Educators Incorporated, has owned the land for decades and announced a deal to sell it to DRP in 2020. In December, officials with DRP said the company planned to begin construction this year. The development will have more than 600 apartments plus office and retail space. Plans also call for 62 workforce housing units in a four-story building. The developers plan to build out the site in two phases. This project will be monumental not only for our company, but for the city of Raleigh, DRP Chairman and CEO Andy Andrews says. An incredible amount of hard work has gone into this project already, and we are thankful to the North Carolina Association of Educators for working with us over the last 2 years as we have navigated the uncharted waters of a global pandemic. Construction on Phase 1 will include the first 20-story tower, complete with 304 apartments plus commercial and office space, as well as the four-story multifamily structure wrapping a parking deck. The first apartments are expected to open in spring 2024. On the office side, the project will be home to the new headquarters for Dogwood State Bank in the Phase 1 tower. The bank, currently headquartered off Six Forks Road, will also operate a retail banking location on the ground floor. Apex Development has 240 apartments, commercial space. A Virginia developer has plans to bring a new development to Apex, joining a rush of investor and developer interest in the town. Last year, Castle Development Partners of Charlottesville filed plans for North Salem Station, calling for up to 240 apartments and 10,000 square feet of commercial space on the north side of town. The project is situated on 9 parcels at the corner of North Salem Street and Laura Duncan Road near the border with Cary's city limits. Castle Development Partners bought the assemblage in December for $4 million. The site is bifurcated by North Salem Street, and the developer plans to have the multifamily on the north side of the street with the non-residential space planned for parcels on the south side of the street. Texas developer eyes Durham for 1.5 million square feet of space. A Houston developer is joining the rush for industrial space in the Triangle with plans to build a huge industrial park in North Durham. Last month, Welcome Group LLC filed plans with the city for the Welcome Venture Park, calling for around 1.5 million square feet of industrial space across a 160-acre assemblage. The project is situated at 1225, 1507, 1539 Hamlin, and 1420 Old Oxford Roads. The land is currently owned by Winston-Salem-based Eno Development Partners, LLC, managed by Thomas Crumpler, according to state records. Welcome Group is asking the city to rezone the properties to make way for the project. Timeline and pricing details were not included in filings with the city. And we have a section called By the Numbers. Rents in Raleigh continued to rise in February as occupancy hovered around 94%. According to the latest monthly report by ApartmentData.com, the group found that in February, average rents came in at $1,425 a month, up from $1,416 the month before. Occupancy dipped slightly to 93.9% last month, down from 94% in January and 94.1% in December. And finally, a big number, $35.5 million. That's how much an LLC addressed to Harbor International Group paid in February for the 176-unit Nova Chapel Hill Apartments in Durham. The deal breaks down to $201,590.91 per unit. The property is situated on 17.5 acres at 5639 Old Chapel Hill Road near the Chapel Hill Wegmans. And now we turn to A Better World, inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene. UNC seeks to connect young adults to rewarding careers, written by Zach Ezone. UNC Chapel Hill is aiming to help young adults who were hit particularly hard during the pandemic find pathways toward careers. The university launched a program, March 16 that will work with partners in select communities throughout the state to support young adults between the ages of 16 and 24 who are not enrolled in an educational institution or on a career path toward a living wage, says Anita Brown Graham, a professor with the University School of Government, who is leading this effort. The program is focusing on young adults who may have previously worked in hospitality, retail, and other similar industries that were hit hardest by COVID-19. According to the Economic Policy Institute, the unemployment rate for young workers reached 24.4% in spring 2020, up from 8.4% during the same time the previous year. We're looking for opportunities to upskill those young adults who right now are not positioned to gain employment that offers a living wage, Brown Graham says. It's not just about, can we get you in a job? It's, can we get you in a job that leads to a career? The university is accepting applications from communities that have the buy-in of local government, schools, employers, and other stakeholders interested in addressing local workforce issues. Brown Graham says this list of applicants will be narrowed in May to 20 communities that the university will work with over the duration of this two-year project. The types of services the university provides and the industries it focuses on will depend on the needs of the local community. Brown Graham says the university will offer support services that could include access to micro-credentials that people can earn quickly, grant writing support that helps organizations apply for funding, and evidence-based programming aimed at meeting the educational and non-academic needs of the targeted population. The university will also provide support to employers. For instance, Brown Graham says the program could help employers improve their human resource policies and practices and improve whether they are family-friendly toward young people with children. It's really a 360 program that is trying to match employers with employees that they sorely need in this economy and employees with opportunities that will allow them and their families to thrive, she says. This program, titled Our State, Our Work, Connecting Young Adults with Their Future, is part of the university's Carolina Across 100 initiative. This is a five-year initiative named after the university's intentions of touching every county in North Carolina that aims to address new and longstanding issues exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. This recently announced program is the first to come out of this initiative, which launched last year with a statewide survey that received responses from more than 3,000 North Carolinians. Educational disruptions and employment instability were the two negative impacts of the pandemic most mentioned by survey responders. The university will use the results of this survey to shape the program and future efforts under the Carolina Across 100 initiative. While the focus of the next program within this initiative has yet to be decided, Brown Graham says the university plans to touch every part of the state over the duration of this effort. The key is, at the end of 4 years, we want to be able to look at every county and say, we did something, and the something that we did was what the community said was their priority, she says. And there are also some news items on the A Better World page. Leanne Rimes helps raise hope at fundraiser. A local effort to battle mental illness received a major boost in February as a total of $969,000 was raised. Singer Leanne Rimes appeared at the Foundation of Hope's Evening of Hope, February 9, and the Band of Oz performed at the event February 10. Both events were at the pavilion at the Angus Barn. The funds raised helped the Foundation of Hope's new research program for children and teens, the Child and Adolescent Anxiety and Mood Disorders Program, or CHAMP, CHAAMP. The Foundation of Hope was formed in 1984 by Thad and Alice Ure after their son Thad was diagnosed as being bipolar. Chapel Hill event raises help for a children's center. A fundraiser for a new pediatric rehabilitation facility at UNC Children's Hospital had a big day the same day UNC men's basketball team won at Duke University. The Rivalry Roundup 4 pediatric rehab raised around a gross amount of $212,000, organizers say. A year ago, Chapel Hill boy Lee Fitch was struck by an SUV and badly injured. His family of Fitch Lumber and Carborough realized UNC did not have a rehab facility and has joined with UNC football coach Mac Brown and his wife Sally to raise money for such a facility. The goal is to raise $20 million to fund the Fitch Family Comprehensive Pediatric Rehabilitation Center. And finally, Daniel Center names Adagian its new leader. Dr. Emily Adagian has been named the Clinical Executive Director of Lucy Daniel Center, the largest service provider of children's mental health services in the Triangle. Dr. Adagian's extensive knowledge of our mission, along with years of experience working in a variety of roles serving children and families, makes her well-positioned to lead our organization going forward, said Derek Watson, the chair of the board of directors. A psychologist, Adagian joined the Lucy Daniels Center in 2016 as a therapist in the Farley Manning Family Guidance Service, FGS. She called it a great privilege to lead the continued work of the center. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Things to Know About Fraud Czar Focused on PPP. Shortly after the U.S. government announced a $1 trillion-plus rescue plan to help the nation's businesses some 2 years ago, I wrote a column about not being surprised if the same government creates an audit unit inside the U.S. Department of Justice to look for fraud. Well, word came out a few days ago that the DOJ has done exactly that. Associate Deputy Attorney General Kevin Chambers will serve as the director for COVID-19 fraud enforcement. Chambers will lead the department's efforts that to date have resulted in criminal charges against more than 1,000 defendants, with alleged losses exceeding $1.1 billion. The seizure of over $1 billion in economic injury disaster loan proceeds and over 240 civil investigations into more than 1,800 individuals and entities for alleged misconduct in connection with pandemic relief loans totaling more than $6 billion. For most large businesses that received millions of dollars in different tranches during the past 2 years, be assured that the government will look deeply into your books in the coming months. Because of resources, the chance of an audit seems less likely for companies that have paid back the loan. But for small and medium-sized businesses that have received hundreds of thousands of dollars or perhaps a seven-figure loan amount, don't be surprised if the grantee gets a call from a member of Chambers' team. So what is DOJ looking for as it sifts through millions of pages of data supplied through financial institutions by these businesses? In its official statement, DOJ notes, Chambers plans to focus on large-scale criminal enterprises and foreign actors who sought to profit at the expense of the American people. This will include establishing strike teams to prepare for the next phase in the Justice Department's efforts to fight pandemic fraud. But a note released by the DOJ just days later talks about how a business lied about receiving Paycheck Protection Program loans totaling $170,000 and another where the PPP loan amounted to $430,000. The first business was charged under the False Claims Act, and the second business was charged with improperly obtaining multiple PPP loans. Businesses should read up on the False Claims Act to make sure everything they have filed and certified is kosher with the law. Moreover, the issue comes to focus when whistleblowers get involved. And that seems to be happening with these COVID loans more than ever. David Caputo, a Harvard Law School alum and Philadelphia attorney who represents whistleblower clients across the nation, says the uber speed of enacting the CARES Act and immediate disbursement of the dollars to Main Street America has opened up the possibility for abuse of the program. Announced fraud losses are significantly less than the real number, Caputo says. I've noticed an increase in inquiries from potential whistleblowers, and I wonder if the latest DOJ action will make others come forward. Caputo adds that while most businesses that really needed the money during the shutdown and the lockdown really don't have to worry about the DOJ coming after them, the feds may be looking at some specific identifiers, among them forging documents. Already, many businesses across the country have been charged with filing bogus documents to secure COVID relief loans, such as PPP and Economic Injury Disaster Loans, or EIDL. False certification. DOJ investigators could ask businesses and business owners to lay out the exact chain of events that led to a false certification. If fraud is detected, the agency likely will decide whether any civil or criminal enforcement is necessary. And padding the worker count. The DOJ could be uncovering more and more of these cases as much of the PPP loan amount was determined by the number of workers, among other things. Still, PPP was an immense success, and millions of businesses were saved because of the program. Undoubtedly, there will be some bad actors. Most are likely not to be caught, but some will be. And the DOJ, in most cases, will make sure people know about it so they will think twice before committing fraud. Chambers is here to make sure taxpayer money is being protected and put to use judiciously. And finally, on this Viewpoint page, we have a letter to the editor from Robert Glazer, president of the North Carolina Automobile Dealers Association. The headline, Don't Blame North Carolina's Auto Dealer Law. As a follow-up to the two recent articles regarding before landing Toyota, NC swung and missed at Ford for 5,800 jobs, and why North Carolina law kept Amazon-backed automaker from putting $5 billion plant here, there is additional information regarding automotive manufacturers and site selection that may add clarity to this story. Since 1983, when Nissan contemplated North Carolina and eventually settled on Smyrna, Tennessee, for an automotive plant, there have been more than 15 opportunities where the Tar Heel State was in the running for an assembly plant. Examples of near misses include BMW in 1994, Hyundai in 2005, Kia in 2009, Mazda and Toyota in 2018. Fortunately, we were able to land the Toyota battery plant south of Greensboro that Governor Roy Cooper announced in December. While your article clearly implies that North Carolina was not chosen due to the state franchise laws, it is highly unlikely that the factory selected another state, such as Georgia, in the case of Rivian, because of the state's motor vehicle laws. More likely, as has been noted with the past near misses by other manufacturers, the economies of scale in opening an automotive assembly plant in an area that does not have an existing parts and component supply infrastructure would make it exceptionally difficult, incredibly expensive, and logistically challenging for an assembly plant to efficiently operate in such an area. Not surprisingly, the southeastern areas that were selected for assembly plants have existing underlying supply chain vendors and established automotive infrastructure. Lastly, the underlying truth of the selection of Georgia for the future Rivian plant as compared to North Carolina is that it was not about state laws. Interestingly, Georgia and North Carolina have very similar state laws that govern the sale of vehicles, and both states prohibit manufacturers, with the limited exception for Tesla, from selling directly to the public. To imply that the motor vehicle laws kept Rivian from selecting North Carolina and instead selected another state with the same laws is patently false. To not reference or remotely discuss the immense cost impact of a missing supply chain network and undeveloped automotive infrastructure is misleading. Thank you very much for the opportunity to add an additional perspective to this recent story. And finally, we have the Business Pulse survey. Should North Carolina legalize online sports betting? There were 144 responses. 78% say yes. 22% say no. And we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.